The world has changed dramatically since our last episode, and so I want to start by reaching out to my podcast community and wishing you all well. Our activities are drastically curtailed. One thing we can do is get out and garden if we're lucky enough to have our own garden, or go on walks and tune in to the natural world. So I'm hoping that my interview with Doug Tallamy will resonate with you. If you are inspired to garden, it may not be possible to go to a nursery to buy plants. One option is that you can order plants online. A couple of sites that I've used in the past are Prairie Nursery and Prairie Moon Nursery, easy to confuse but distinct. Or perhaps you have a local nursery that will still deliver. You can also just look around your garden and see what native plants are already there and what you can do to encourage them. There's a part in my interview with Tallamy about gardening by elimination that you might like. And if you don't have your own garden, take a walk. Tune into the changes of spring. A few weeks ago, this is what I heard as I entered the woods on a walk with my dog. Frogs. The sound of spring. That chirping sound like crickets in the background, those are the spring peepers, the little ones. And the deep, throaty ones that I originally mistook for ducks or geese, those are the wood frogs. At a time when we are kept at a distance from our fellow humans, connecting with other creatures can make us feel less lonely and reaffirm our sense that life goes on. Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world. Quick note before we get started, if you haven't listened to my first episode with Doug Tallamy, which is also my very first episode, especially if you haven't read his first book, Bringing Nature Home, I strongly suggest that you go back and listen to that one first. In this interview, we'll be talking about his latest book, Nature's Best Hope, A New Approach to Conservation That Starts in Your Yard. Doug Tallamy is a professor of entomology at the University of Delaware, and one of the leading voices in the movement to plant with native plants to support wildlife on private property throughout the country. So I just finished reading your new book, and I enjoyed it very much, and I'm looking forward to talking about particularly some of the brand new things that I learned. But okay. But let's start with the big picture. So in the beginning of the book, you make it clear that you're addressing this to everyone, to those who are already concerned about ecological issues and to those who don't think of themselves as nature lovers at all. So perhaps we can start with your argument for why it is that whether we're nature lovers or not, we need to be concerned with the fate of the natural world, with what you call our ecological bank account.
Right. Because we all need it. We all depend on healthy ecosystems. And it's not just the responsibility of a few experts to keep them healthy. It is, as members of planet Earth, we need to all be stewards of planet Earth because we're totally dependent on it. So the idea that some people get to foul our nest and everybody else has to try to clean it up just doesn't make any sense to me. We're not taught good Earth stewardship from day one, but everybody. You know, everybody, whether you live in the middle of a city, whether you own a lot of property, everybody is responsible for how we're treating the planet. It's easiest for people who own property because they can deal with their property and, you know, it's right there, very easy. If you don't own property, you can volunteer in your local parks. They're all understaffed, underfunded, and they love volunteer work. You can vote responsibly. There's a lot of things that every citizen of the planet can and needs to start doing.
Yeah.
Because again, we are part of nature. We depend on it. We're not going to exist without it. And if we wreck it, it's going to hurt everybody.
Yeah. So how do you see the goal? How do you set the terms for the goal of what we need to do in order to avoid what's being called the sixth great extinction?
Well, we're already in that. We can minimize it. Or we can maximize it. And of course, if we do that, then we'll probably go down the tubes too, because there's a relationship between the number of species in an ecosystem and how well it functions. if we lose so many species that all of our ecosystems function really poorly, that's not going to be enough ecosystem services to support our, you know, burgeoning populations. So we want to minimize extinction. We want to minimize local extinction, not just, you know, is there a population somewhere on the planet? We need ecosystem function everywhere, so we need species everywhere. So what I always say is that every bit of terrestrial planet Earth, but let's just talk about our yards, should be doing four things, at least four things. One is support food webs. So we should have plants in our yards that pass their energy on and can support the animal life that helps to run our ecosystems. Every place has to do that. Every place also has to sequester carbon. So we have to have enough plants that are building their bodies out of carbon, but also, even more important, they are pumping that carbon into the soil. And we need to manage watersheds. It's everybody lives in a watershed, and it's the plants on our properties that manage those watersheds properly. And finally, we need to support complex communities of pollinators, mostly native bees, not just a few generalist bees, but, you know, the 4,000 species of native bees that we have in North America. And again, not just in parks and preserves, everywhere, because we need pollination services everywhere. And we don't need them in our crops. I mean, we need them a little bit there, but 80 to 90% of the plants on the planet are pollinated by animals. So if we lose those pollinators, we lose 80 to 90% of the plants. And that's simply not an option. So where are we going to do this? We got to look around. That's got to happen everywhere. And that would be the target, turning residential landscapes, corporate landscapes, roadsides, even to a lesser extent, farmland, into areas that are accomplishing those goals. And by the way, lawn doesn't do any of those things.
Right.
So, you know, our default landscape of turning the world into lawn is other than paving it over, it's the worst thing we can do.
Yeah. So you suggest that one goal that every homeowner can have is to transform half of their lawn into a more ecologically productive landscape.
Right. I mean, that's my suggestion. You're certainly allowed to do more than that.
But. Yes. at the heart of your book is this idea of a homegrown national park, which I thought was a very moving concept. Could you tell me, how did you arrive at that term and maybe describe a little bit what the concept is?
Well, it actually was thinking about lawn that got me there. We have an area of lawn the size of New England. It's more than 40 million acres. And I remember sitting exactly where I'm sitting right now. I'm thinking, what would happen if we cut the area of lawn in half? How much area would that be? Oh, that's at least 20 million acres. And then I said, well, how does that compare to the size of our national parks? And I started to add up the major national parks in the lower 48 states. And I came up with a big, long list. And that includes Yellowstone, the Smokies, and Denali, and all these huge parks. And it was still less than 20 million acres. I said, okay, we can create a new national park, and if we do it largely at home, we can call it Homegrown National Park. I was just kind of fooling around. But it'll be the biggest park, at least in the lower 48. I think the biggest park anywhere. And in a different sense, you know, you don't go there to see the bison or the giant waterfalls, but you can interact with nature at your own speed, on your own terms. You can do it without paying any money. You can do it alone, which is really tough to do these days in our national parks, without the hassle and bustle. You can get a lot of the benefits of interacting with the life around you just by walking out your door if you do this. So the more I thought about it, the more exciting the concept became to me. And that, of course, fills in the gaps in between our real parks and preserves and creates connectivity. It creates the corridors that we need so that all those species that are confined to these natural areas can then actually spill out a little bit, and their populations can be bigger, and they'll be less vulnerable to local extinction. Small populations are really vulnerable to local extinction.
Right, because you talked about how important this the connectivity is, that it really doesn't work to just have these isolated bits of habitat for a number of reasons, one of them being reproduction. that a lot of species need a bigger area to reproduce. One of the examples that you give is the example of the eastern box turtle.
Right.
Which I have a particular affection for. I rescued one once in the middle of a dangerous road. Could you talk about the eastern box turtle a little bit? I have a fantasy of being able to coax one to live in my garden. Is that a totally unrealistic hope?
Depends on how big your garden is.
Yeah.
But, you know, their home range is not very big. How big is your property?
It's about half an acre, maybe a little bit bigger than that. It also links up to a number of other properties that are not fenced in. So.
Right. So that would be the home range of your turtle. And of course, a turtle doesn't want to be alone. You want a population of turtles. So to have, you'd probably need your entire neighborhood, but to have a viable population of box turtles in a typical suburban neighborhood, that would be great. And there's really only a couple of things we need to do. One is we have to stop mowing them.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought about that. That was an interesting thing I learned from reading your book.
Yeah, but they don't travel that far. The males will move around when it's time to mate. They're looking for females. Females want to lay their eggs in the sun. But most of the time, they want to be in shaded areas, you know, woodlot-type situations where they really just tunnel into the leaves and spend an awful lot of time just sitting around. They like to eat slugs, a little bit of fruit here and there. They'll even eat carrion. But we've got a good population of box turtle at our house. We do have 10 acres. But I know they're breeding because every once in a while we'll dig up a baby. They spend the first year underground doing who knows what. But and we have all size classes. So we run into a number of them all season long. So it's, of course, we're on a flag lot. We're pretty far from a road, so they can walk around without getting squished. And that's their biggest danger is getting mowed and run over by cars.
By cars, yeah. So I had a more general question I wanted to address before we move on to some of the specifics. One of the points you make that really resonated with me was that humans respond better to enticement than to punishment, better to carrots than to sticks. And that
Absolutely.
Maybe that's been one of the problems with some of the existing legislation. You mentioned the Endangered Species Act, which of course has done a lot of good. But in order to really start a movement like the homegrown national park that you write about, that perhaps the best method will be finding ways to entice people. So do you have thoughts about what the carrots are that we can use?
Okay, I'm actually starting to accumulate examples where this is happening. I wrote the book you just read 2 years ago. Actually, I wrote it 3 years ago, and then it took 2 years to get it out. So in that time period, I'm running across examples where municipalities are encouraging people to do this type of thing. So the state of Minnesota, for example, has a cost-sharing program where if you turn part of your yard into a prairie, they will help you pay for that. And that does two things. It does three things. It says to the culture, this is important, and we as a state are willing to actually pay for it. And it gives cultural permission to everybody who's worried about what their neighbors are going to think. Say, hey, I'm just doing what the state wants me to do. You know, I'm actually saving a little money doing it.
Right.
And that's the big difference. If we changed our tax structure so that you got a little tax break, and it didn't have to be much. It just says, this is the thing I should do to be a good citizen. Because right now, a lot of people think, well, the thing I should do to be a good citizen is mow my yard. And, you know, they're not thinking about the ecological consequences. So that's one example. Another example is there's some small islands off the Keys in Florida that have burrowing owls. And the islands are paying people to allow the burrowing owls to burrow in their front yards. Without eliminating it. So in other words, if you have a burrowing owl, they pay you something. So it's exactly that carrot and stick idea with the Endangered Species Act. If we paid people to have endangered species on their properties, believe me, everybody would want one.
Yeah.
And it would be cheaper than all the lawsuits to try to get people to stop killing them.
Yeah.
Those are two examples that I know of right away, but I'm sure there's more, and I'm trying, if you ever hear of any, send them to me.
Yeah, I will. No, I mean, I like the idea of government subsidies, and I think that that's something that people can lobby for. You know, I think there are a lot of government entities that probably would be receptive to thinking something like that. I'm also thinking, yeah, like, just in terms of sort of neighborhood organizations and things like that, one,
right,
of the things that's taken off here is this pollinator pathways. And so, you know, through the school garden, through the local garden club and various entities, people are being encouraged and sometimes it's simple things too. Like I had an explosion of milkweed seedlings last year.
Oh, really?
And so I just posted online and gave a lot of them away, which, you know, people are surprisingly happy to take those on. So I'm optimistic on the one hand. On the other hand, I still see a lot of lawn around. And like you say, I think there's a cultural shift that needs to happen as well, like in terms of how people understand their relationship to their property.
Yeah. So we're headed in the right direction. We're not there yet. But what's going to happen is we're going to reach a threshold where it becomes common enough. You know, it's all tied to status. And if the status becomes ecological landscaping, your neighbor and the people who don't think about that will do it just so they fit in. You know, instead of right now, we do all the destructive things just so we fit in with our neighborhood standards. Well, those standards are going to change. And that, when that happens, it's really going to take off.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I do like to think of ways that we could make changes easy and cheap for people too.
I mean, some
people have the money to spend, obviously, but I know in my case, I take on a little project each year, you know. One of the things I wonder about is using seeds more. And I know that that can be difficult with native plants. One of the things is often that you need to seed them in the fall or in the winter rather than in the spring. And sometimes you need to sort of prepare an area. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, yeah. Mostly with woody plants. So most of the oak trees on our property, I started from acorns. Free, cheap, easy. The hard part then becomes when they germinate, protecting them from the deer. So I had to put little fences around them, make them bigger fences. But, you know, now I've got a lot of 20, 30, 40 foot oaks that we started from acorns. So that's certainly possible. You know, making a prairie is one of the hardest things to do. So if you're going to start all that from seed, you're right. You need to know what you're doing. The soil has to be prepared. You have to recognize the young plants because they just look like little teeny weeds. You have to be patient. There's a guy, Jack Pizzo, in the Midwest, has a restoration business. And he'll be corporate landscapes and everything. But he says, when you hire me, it's a 3-year contract. You cannot fire me before 3 years. Because the first year you're going to hate it, the second year you're going to, you know, wonder, and the third year you're going to love it. Because that's how long it takes for these plants to get going and come up and start blooming. And a lot of people don't have the patience for that. So
yeah,
that's when people say, well, I'm going to get rid of my lawn and make a prairie. I say, well, you can, but that's the hardest thing. You know, just planting a bush or a tree is a whole lot easier.
Yeah. So. Well, they do make these, like, one year I ordered from Prairie Nursery, they make these kits, you know, where a number of plugs, and it does take 3 years until it's fully developed, but you know, you get things blooming in the first year and it's not so bad. So here's a sort of random question. Is there any virtue to just letting part of your lawn grow wild and introducing some native plants here and there, or does that really not accomplish very much?
No, I mean, we call that addition by subtraction, where you don't spend that much time planning, but you do have to remove the things you don't want. So when you just let an area go, a lot of what comes in are the invasive species we don't want. But natives do come in as well. And if you consistently remove the non-natives you don't want, that gives the competitive advantage to the natives. If you take an existing lawn and simply stop mowing it, things will come in. But turf grass is... It's a good competitor, you know, really dense root system, and a lot of things have trouble getting in there to begin with.
Yeah.
So So people who actually really want to do it, they do their best to kill off the grass first.
Yeah.
And a number of methods to do that. And then that speeds up the process. But simply not mowing, that helps one of the goals that you're after. And that's that watershed management, because a lawn that is allowed to grow up will capture more water. It encourages infiltration. And of course, you're no longer putting the fertilizer and pesticides on it, which reduces the pollution effect that lawns typically have. So if somebody wants to do that, that is better than not doing it. Eventually, woodies will come into that, depending on where you live. And if you keep the good ones and get rid of the bad ones, you can transform that into one of the most valuable habitats, and that's the scrub habitat, that transition between the forest and the meadow. Mm. There are very few of those around. There are a number of birds that only breed in habitats like that. So I don't want to discourage anybody from doing that, and it comparatively can be easy. If it's your front yard, it often doesn't look that nice.
Right,
so
right.
Placing it in the proper place is important.
Yeah. You do mention that some things that we call weeds are good. Obviously, there are a lot of native plants that have the word weed attached to them.
Right.
That for me personally, it doesn't have that stigma because I came into gardening at the same time that I learned about native plants. So, uh-huh. You know how it is with names. Like if you form a positive association with a name, that kind of has a way of sticking. That said, there are some things you mention as serving as host plants that I was really surprised by, including ragweed, plantain, smartweed. You said those are things that we don't necessarily need to eliminate. Am I right on that?
Well, if you know, for maximum biodiversity, that is correct. Ragweed does make us sneeze. I mean, there's no doubt about it.
And right.
Both my wife and I suffer from hay fever. We don't do anything to get rid of the ragweed, but we can certainly sympathize with people who don't want to tolerate it.
Yeah.
But smartweed and plantain, you know, there are non-native plantains, but there are native plantains as well. And it's one of those genera that all the species are closely related. So the leaf chemistry is very similar.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of caterpillars that spend a lot of their time on the ground just walking around eating things that really depend on plantain. It's a very, very good plant, just like dandelion. Dandelion's not native. It's kind of pan-global, but a lot of things like it. And so, but leaving it does help the biodiversity in your yard.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned that
that goes for poison ivy too.
Oh yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, that's a tricky one. So you mentioned that, you know, you don't necessarily want to let your lawn grow in the front yard. My technique, which has been not entirely deliberate, has been to have things be neater the closer they are to the street. And then in the far back of the garden, it's, you know, kind of wild. So that might be one thing to think about, too, is that, you know, you can have sort of different aesthetic approaches depending on where it is and, you know, how public it is.
Yeah, no, sure. You know, I always say if you're going to cut your lawn in half, the part you keep should be manicured because that's a real cue for care. And it shows you care about your landscape. And this is just a new design. And you are keeping your lawn up. You just have less of it.
Yeah.
And then the other areas become well planted with good ground covers. And they all can look very nice.
Yeah.
It's not just a matter of you know, not tending to anything.
No. I mean, somebody like Carolyn Summers has shown that you can have a very formal garden made out of native plants. The aesthetic is not determined by the kind of plants that you use entirely. So one of the things I learned from reading your book is that if you have a large tree, for instance, I have a very large pin oak on my property and it's surrounded by grass, the caterpillars that develop on the leaves and then drop to the ground won't be able to burrow. So could you first describe a little bit the life cycle of the different caterpillars and then speak to sort of how that part of the garden should be managed in order to, you know, make it possible for them to complete their life cycle?
That's a very important and actually brand new thing that we're thinking about. About 94% of the caterpillars that develop on oaks don't complete their life cycle on the oak. They do drop from the tree, and they either spin a cocoon in the leaf litter under the tree, or they actually tunnel into the soil. And they'll do that wherever they can. So if they drop down and it's really compacted, they'll start walking until they get to a place where they can tunnel in. Some of them actually tunnel into wood, old decaying wood, but most of them go underground. And what we want to do is make that easy for them. So this lawn right up to the base of the tree is no good for the tree, first of all. And it's certainly no good for the caterpillars. This summer, we're going to start a project that is going to measure survivorship in a situation like that and then compare it to areas where you have a ground cover like wild ginger or bay apples or your spring ephemerals, any place where you're not running the mower over it and you're not walking over it. The prediction is then caterpillar survivorship is going to be much higher there. So a good way to reduce the area in lawn is to create these, they would call them caterpillar beds, underneath your trees where there was lawn and now there's not going to be lawn. And it won't take long for the soil to loosen up and create a healthy soil horizon, a lot of organic matter, and the caterpillars, you know, should do really well, and you have less lawn. But we haven't, it's been less than a year that we've been thinking about this. And when you look around, that's what, right, you know, 99% of our trees are doing is sitting in the middle of the lawn.
Yeah.
So, another big transition.
So let's talk about practically how to do that, because it can be difficult to plant under a large tree that has all these roots in place. So this is what I'm thinking, and tell me if I'm right. I'm thinking first, allow a lot of leaves to be there. I've already killed a bunch of the lawn there. So kill the lawn by having a bunch of leaves there, which will loosen up the soil. And then, but then how do I plant? Because it can be rather difficult to insert plants among a complicated root system. So is this a situation where I'm using seeds, or am I trying to tuck in plugs here and there? Or?
Yeah. It's picking the proper ground cover where you're going to win or lose. So things that do really well in heavy shade, like wild ginger, would be a great choice. And get some plugs and plant it in there. And they're not very deep rooted. They'll run along the surface. You know, violets. Violets need sun to bloom, but they don't need to bloom. And they'll be very shallow rooted. Any of your spring ephemerals that way they're typically forest species that are used to heavy shade. So I agree. Get your leaf litter there. That's where you rake your leaves and let it sit and build up some really carbon rich A horizon there, and then plant into that. And see how it goes. I mean, some of this is going to be experimentation. And you know, there are areas under a tree that get more light and areas that get less light. So it depends on if the tree is out in the middle of nothing, then it should have equal amounts of light. But if it's next to another tree, that side's going to be even darker. So think about those things. Which areas are most exposed? Because those areas are probably get the most water as well. And then just play with it. This is where, I don't know, you know, gardening experimentation can be fun. See what works. Take before and after pictures to see how it's going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a nice idea. So you also mentioned that when you're planting trees, one technique that you recommend is planting sort of three or four trees close to each other so that the root matrix forms in a way that makes them sturdier.
Right.
That was an interesting tip.
Another new concept. We've always planted, trying to create specimen trees because we want the tree to be as big as it possibly could be and spread. And we want that because it's beautiful. And I understand that. But that's not the way trees grow in a forest. And with our crazy climate these days, where you get a ton of rain and then high winds, it does topple those isolated trees. Particularly if they're planted on top of a pan where the roots are not very deep, they're really vulnerable to falling over and hitting a car or a house. And we always hear somebody was crushed by a tree, and then everybody, let's get rid of all the trees. So planting in these little tree groves, and it might just be as simple as two trees. Three has got to be better, but two, you know, could work. Yeah. You got to plant them young so that they can develop their root matrix. When they're young, you know, planting a 15-foot white oak, in my opinion, is a waste of money. It's got a 50% chance of dying. Its root system has been severely pruned. It'll spend more than a decade trying to rebuild it. That's the worst way to get get this root matrix. Start young so they can intertwine with each other. In theory, that ought to be a whole lot more stable. You know, we need a lot of people who do it, and then we need 20 years to look at it. But
right.
But we have to start at some point.
Yeah. I just, one quick follow-up question to when we were talking about the trees and the caterpillars. So is it like early fall or mid-fall when they're dropping from the tree? I'm just curious.
Well, there's a succession of species from late April, depending on where you live. But
oh, wow.
Late April, May, all the way into October, yeah.
Oh, wow. So it goes really throughout a big part of the year.
That's right. That's right. We do have the, I would say August is the time where most species are developing and dropping to the ground. But it doesn't mean they're not doing it other times of the year.
Okay, that's interesting. So let's talk about bees a little bit. There's a lot more about bees and specifically native bees in this book. So there are a number of interesting tips you give us for how to make our properties bee-friendly. One, of course, is not cutting down plants in the fall. Leaving the stems. And I have to say, I find them quite attractive. So I see no aesthetic reason not to leave them. There's also a toilet paper roll trick. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. That would be for bumblebees.
Okay.
And what you do is you take a unused toilet paper roll and stand it on its end so that you can look at the hole right down there, and you bury it so that it's level with the soil. And you have to do it in an area that's dry. So under the eaves or under a porch or someplace that it's not going to get rained on, because that'll ruin it.
Okay.
Or build a little rock shelter and put it under there. And the bumblebees come along, the queen bumblebees come along, and they get into there and chew it up and make it into their little nest. And then they like to nest in cavities, protected cavities, so either in rock walls or under the ground, old mouse nests. And this provides an opportunity for them to do that. I discovered this when I was, you can actually do that to a way of assessing whether you have termites near your house, because they'll get in there as well.
Hmm.
So I had these toilet paper rolls surrounding the house because I suspected we had termites. I didn't find any termites, but I did get a couple of bumblebee nests and said, oh, that was pretty easy. So.
It sounds like maybe a fun thing to do with kids as well.
That's right. Yeah. And I would do it, I would have it in the ground from early April. Because that's when the queens come out and start looking around to start a colony.
Okay, that's good to know. Maybe I'll suggest we do that in the school garden this year.
Maybe even mid-March. Maybe even mid-March.
Okay.
You know, the spring is so early this year, so.
You also talk about the importance of host plants for bees, and that was a new thing for me as well. And that's because certain bee species require pollen from particular plants, correct?
Right. They're host plant specialists, just like many of the caterpillars are. Well, we don't know how many species of bees are specialists, but the more people look, the more they find. And that distinguishes them from the generalist bees, like bumblebees. Most bumblebees are generalists. Honeybee is certainly a big generalist. And they can go to a lot of different types of flowers, including non-native flowers that have a lot of nectar. So they go in there and people say, oh, look, my non-native is great for the bees. I'm saving the bees. And you're actually helping a couple species of generalists. But we need to help all those specialists, too. And what it means is they require the pollen usually of a genus. So like they require willow pollen, or they require goldenrod pollen or sunflower pollen. And if you don't have those plants in your yard, and it's usually, 10, 12, 14 species, we've lost a lot of species that could potentially be nesting in your yard.
So if you had to recommend five plant genera for people to plant, let's say on the East Coast for bees, what would you recommend?
Goldenrod, solidago, asters, native willows, so things like pussy willow and black willow, Oenothera, evening primrose is a big one. Violets are big ones. And did I say sunflowers? Sunflowers.
I think you mentioned sunflowers, yeah. Particular kinds of sunflowers?
Yeah, one that's an unaltered straight species native.
Okay.
So there's a lot of species of helianthus, particularly as you move further west, but there are some perennial sunflowers in the east And those are the ones we're talking about, not the giants that you get the seed for the birds from. Those have been manipulated so much that that's probably not what we're talking about.
Okay. And you mentioned that you talk about, because some people have fear of bees because of the fear of being stung, and you sort of break down what the actual danger is, which is fairly limited. Certain kinds of bees that guard their nests.
Like honeybees, you know.
Right, like honeybees.
That don't really belong here. They're the most aggressive, and but most people do not have a honeybee hive on their property.
But you say that when they're foraging for nectar and pollen, they're actually generally unlikely to sting you. And you mentioned that you can actually pet bees, which I have heard before. Is that something that I imagine you've pet bees?
They'll fly away. They don't really like it. But you know, their job is to gather the pollen and get back to the hive or their single nest.
Yeah.
And they're to sting, you know, if it's a honeybee, when they sting you, they're dead.
Right.
So the only reason they're going to do that is to protect their hive. And when they're out foraging, they're not protecting their hive. So they don't want to do that. Most of the time when people get stung, it's not a bee at all. It's a yellow jacket or a bald-faced hornet. They'll call it a bee, but it's not. And I'm not suggesting that you keep your bald-faced hornet nest right on your eave, because they're aggressive. They do come out and sting you. And that's not what we're talking about. Those are wasps. They're predators. They're actually eating the caterpillars that we're trying to promote for the birds. So I'm talking about true bees, and they, you know, that 4,000 species of native bees, almost all of them are solitary, and it is hard to get stung. You got to work at it. So the danger is just about nothing from those species.
Can you explain, I mean, I can tell visually, but can you explain what the difference between bees and wasps are from a scientific perspective or from...
They eat different things.
Okay.
True bees live off of pollen and nectar. They are herbivores, all right? They're not predators at all. Wasps are predators, and they're meat eaters. So they catch other insects. They do love caterpillars, and they feed that meat to their offspring. So they're doing totally different things. To actually look at them morphologically, well, first of all, most wasps don't have many hairs. The hairs on a bee are branched. So they're plumose hairs. And it comes off the thorax and then it branches into little other hairs. So if you're looking under a microscope, it's very fuzzy. Whereas a wasp does have hairs, those hairs are never branched. That would be the official way you can tell. Plus the wing venation is different. These are all things that the homeowner's not going to look at.
Right. I also wanted to ask you about the effect of Roundup on bees. And part of the reason I bring this up is because my latest interview was on GMOs. And the topic of Roundup resistant corn came up as an example to talk about it. And, you know, it's a complicated topic. And the scientist I was talking to wasn't making a pro or con argument, but he was saying one of the advantages to being able to, for a farmer being able to spray Roundup, is that they don't have to till the soil, so they can have a no-till method. But I wanted to further unpack that. So how damaging is Roundup to bees, and should this factor into people's practices on their own property?
In agriculture, it's the misuse of Roundup that's damaging.
The misuse.
The concept of being able to spray the field so that you don't have to till to get rid of weeds, it's true. That's no-till. That's good. That's a lot of product being put on an acre. The problem comes when they don't just spray it on their crop. They spray it right up to the road. It knocks out all of the, quote, weeds that are the native plants, the pollen producers, the nectar producers, the milkweeds, the asters, all the things that support the monarch when they're migrating, and all of the other, the community of insects that are using these native plants that used to be along the edges of farm fields. They're gone, and now it's lawn. You could drive across Iowa and Illinois, and that's the new high-class farmer has replaced, because he can so easily get rid of all those weeds, he sprayed it all and planted lawn. And it looks really nice, but then it's absolutely sterile. You got tens of millions of acres in the Midwest that are absolutely sterile. And it's that Roundup product that allowed them to do that. So if that was against the law, if it was, no, you've got to have pollinator strips on the sides of your corn and your soybean, because those crops are absolutely sterile. You know, if it was a rule, this is where it would help the cultural change, because then the grower could say, okay, I'm still a high class grower, but I am not allowed to do that. And rather than leave it up to the conscience of the grower, because there's dual forces here. There's the perception that you're not a responsible grower if you allow weeds to be on the side of your yard, because now you have the means to get rid of them. Versus the, this is an ecological disaster, but ignorance reigns, and most people aren't focusing on that. Although that is changing. There are a lot of areas in Iowa, for example, where they're really working, particularly on roadsides, to put the prairie plants back. And they're having a lot of success. I think when you add up all the mileage they've done, it's over 1,000 miles that they've replanted. But boy, you know, the last 10 years or so, it's been brutal. And that is the major cause for the decline of the monarch over that period, is the elimination of milkweed on the edges of agriculture. We're not talking about encouraging it in the middle of the crops. It's not there. They've already sprayed it. Nothing's going to grow in there. You don't need to kill the plants on the edge of your properties either. So that's where Roundup is directly impacting our native bees, is by eliminating the forage that they need. They need that forage all season long.
Okay, so the chemical itself doesn't necessarily have an impact. It's one of the dilemmas for me. So I don't generally use pesticides or herbicides, but there are certain situations in which it limits you. So one of the pests that I deal with on my property is goutweed, which is one of those things that, like, if you take it out by the roots and you miss like an inch of root, it will grow back vigorously. And so part of me wonders if I should use an herbicide on that so that I could then replant it with something else. But I also wonder about the other impacts that might have.
Yeah, I am not opposed to responsible use of herbicides, and I do it myself. I don't usually spray, I paint.
Right.
So I cut and I paint. But there's some things, like we have a terrible problem with Japanese stiltgrass. Mm. You don't cut and paint that. I mean, but I haven't sprayed it either. It's everywhere, you know, and it's right now it's beating me. We'll have to think of a way to get around it. But but for woody plants, you know, I'm not going to live long enough to just cut them back. Things like Oriental bittersweet. If you don't kill the roots, it never goes away. Mm-hmm. And it's back, and you got to do it all the time. And so I do. I cut and I paint. Same thing with autumn olives. Same thing with multiflora rose. And porcelain berries, a terrible one now. But it's using very little product. So.
Yeah, it's never a perfect art gardening, right? It's messy and experimental, and you have to be open to...
And life is a trade-off, I say 1,000 times a day. You know, you've got to weigh the costs and the benefits. Do the costs outweigh the benefits, or vice versa? And when the benefits of doing this exceed the costs, I do it.
Yeah. Well, you write about the joys of this, and, you know, I'd like to sort of end on a more positive note. And one of the things you talk about is, which I find moving because it definitely speaks to me, is the idea that we need to think of ourselves as responsible for the other animals that share our space. And you say, for instance, you must assume responsibility for the well-being of your cardinal, your blue jay, and your American toad.
Right. They're your pets.
Yeah. So, and there is something, and you also write about how much more we know about how essential relationships to nature are to our well-being, and how, ironically, that's becoming less and less accessible, particularly for kids. And you write about how, you know, as a child, you just were able to run wild and explore, and that happens so much less frequently now. But one way to do that is to create these spaces in your gardens where, you know, kids can discover.
Yeah. You know, we take kids on field trips so they can be exposed to nature. And so they get in a bus and they drive an hour and they're out there for maybe an hour. And they get back in the bus, they come back. And that is better than nothing. But what they're really experiencing is interacting with 30 other kids and teachers telling them what they're not allowed to touch.
Right.
It is not the type of experience that I grew up with or that I think they need, where they go out, they just sit on a log and, you know, you might be planning to build a fort or something, but while you're sitting there, things happen and you didn't plan on seeing something, but all of a sudden it's there. Those are the interactions that will never happen on that class trip that our kids are missing, but could start to experience if we did this in our yards. It's going to be tough for those kids that live in the middle of the city. And I guess they do get on that bus, but we are learning. I mean, there's a new book that I, you know, we didn't encounter. I don't think it was out when I actually wrote Nature's Best Hope. What's it called? The one about, you know, all the health benefits of nature. The Nature Fix by Florence Williams goes into the latest research on exposure to nature. And it's even more powerful than we thought. I mean, apparently normal child brain development requires exposure to nature and all these crazy things that nobody was thinking about. So,
yeah.
That's important. We got to do it.
Yeah. I mean, I think it reminds me that that's really what triggered our move to the suburbs was we were living in Brooklyn when my kids were little and coming up to Westchester County at one point and just being in a park where there was a stream and seeing right. how they gravitated to the stream and played in the stream. And
yeah,
it's just, yeah. it's a very powerful thing.
Yeah.
So, well, hopefully the word will get out more and more. I will certainly do my part to let people know about your book and these interesting ideas. I think it is reason to be hopeful. And I think it's also one of the things, you know, in our current climate, it's something that cuts across political lines too, which is nice.
Yeah. I hate the politicizing of environmentalists, which of course happened a long time ago, but that term makes no sense to me because it suggests only certain people need a healthy environment. Nobody else needs it. And it's crazy. Everybody needs it. So that, you know, this is not something that we're going to divide up into camps. Everybody needs a healthy environment, not political at all.
Right. Nobody should have a monopoly on nature. It's it cuts through everything. It is everything. So it's sort of absurdist to think otherwise. I hope this episode gave you some thoughts of things to do during your time of confinement. In upcoming episodes, we'll be looking at visions of the apocalypse. Seems a little too apt, right? As the teenage son of a friend of mine said, I thought the end of the world would be more fun. Take care. If you have a moment, please give me a positive review in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, and tell a friend that while stuck at home, they can listen to the In the Weeds podcast. I'll be back soon.